Imagine it is 7 in the morning. You roll out of bed, stumble to the kitchen, and start making coffee. Beans from Ethiopia, roasted in Hamburg, shipped through Rotterdam.
You drive to a bakery where fresh bread appeared overnight. You fill your tank at a petrol station that somehow never runs out.
You go to work in your phone with microchips designed in California, manufactured in Taiwan, assembled in Vietnam, connects you to the world in milliseconds. Nobody organized any of that.
There is no Ministry of Morning Routines. No committee decided how much bread Munich needs today, or what the exchange rate between Ethiopian coffee farmers and German baristas should be. It just works.
Now here is the question that should genuinely disturb you. How? How does a global economy involving billions of people, millions of products, and trillions of daily decisions coordinate itself with nobody in charge?
Think about what has to go right for a cup of coffee to appear on your table. Farmers in the Ethiopian highlands had to decide to plant those beans years ago. Traders had to agree on a price. Ships had to be scheduled. Customs cleared. Roasters decided how to roast for your taste. Your cafe stocked it.
None of those people know each other. None of them had a shared plan. None of them had the full picture of the chain they were part of. And yet, reliably, every single morning the coffee arrives.
Now contrast that with what happened when societies tried to replace this with a plan. The Soviet Union tried to centrally coordinate an entire economy. By the late 1980s, there were chronic shortages of basic goods. Bread queues. Empty shelves. An empire that could build nuclear weapons couldn't reliably supply sausages to its citizens.
The Soviet Central Planning Bureau, Gosplan, employed thousands of economists working with the best information available. They set prices for hundreds of thousands of goods. And the results were consistently, reliably worse than the messy, unplanned market they were trying to replace.
This was not because Soviet economists were stupid. They were not. It was because the task they were attempting was, as Hayek would argue, fundamentally impossible.
And the question is not, did Soviet planning fail? That is settled. The question is why? What structural feature of central planning made failure inevitable? That is Hayek's question. And it is one of the most important questions anyone has ever asked about how societies organize themselves.
Welcome to Claude Talks. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Emma. Today we go deep on Friedrich Hayek, the economist who spent his entire life trying to answer that question. One of the most influential, most misunderstood, and most politically contentious thinkers of the 20th century.
We're covering the knowledge problem, spontaneous order, the road to serfdom, the great Hayek versus Keynes debate, and whether his ideas are even more relevant in 2026 than they were in 1945. Fair warning, Emma and I don't agree on everything here. I find Hayek's core insights genuinely important, but I think he was taken too far, and his framework has some real blind spots.
And I think the blind spots are real, but the core insight is more powerful than critics give it credit for. This is a topic where serious people disagree, and we want to do it justice.
Hayek is one of those thinkers who gets weaponized by both sides. The right uses him to justify dismantling everything. The left dismisses him because of that. And in both cases, the actual ideas get lost.
So let us try to actually engage with the ideas, which means starting with who Hayek was and what he was trying to solve.
Friedrich August von Hayek. Born in Vienna in 1899, died in Freiburg in 1992. 92 years old. He saw the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, two world wars, the rise and fall of communism, Keynesian economics, monetarism, and Thatcherism. He outlived most of the movements he helped shape.
He served in the First World War as a young officer on the Italian front. That experience shaped him. He came back to Vienna convinced that something had gone terribly wrong with the political and economic ideas that led Europe into catastrophe.
He studied under Ludwig von Mises, already the central figure of what became the Austrian School of Economics. Karl Menger had founded it in the 1870s, Mises extended it, and Hayek became its most famous voice.
The Austrian school is important to understand because it is genuinely different from mainstream economics. Most economic models then and now are mathematical. Aggregate supply, aggregate demand, GDP, unemployment rates. equations that describe the whole economy in terms of measurable totals.
And the Austrian said, that is precisely the wrong way to think about it. Economic phenomena don't emerge from aggregates. They emerge from individual human choices, made in specific circumstances, based on individual knowledge and preferences. You cannot compress that into an equation without losing everything that matters.
Which puts them on a collision course with central planning from the start. If you think you can model the economy mathematically, you might think you can optimize it mathematically. If you think economic reality is irreducibly individual and local, optimization from the top looks impossible by definition.
There is also the Austrian theory of business cycles, which Hayek developed with Mises. The idea that when central banks artificially suppress interest rates, they flood the economy with cheap credit. Businesses invest in projects that only look profitable at artificially low borrowing costs.
And when rates normalize or inflation forces the central bank's hand, those projects unravel. The boom planted the seeds of the bust. This was Hayek's explanation for why the market has boom and bust cycles.
It turned out to be remarkably relevant to 2008. The housing bubble was inflated by years of cheap credit after the dot-com crash. When it popped, the collapse tracked exactly what Austrian business cycle theory would have predicted. Though we'll get to that.
Hayek moved to the London School of Economics in 1931. That's where he met Keynes, and where the great intellectual battle of the century began. He later moved to the University of Chicago, and then Freiburg in Germany. In 1974, he won the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, shared in what may be the most ironic Nobel pairing in history with Gunnar Myrdal, a Swedish economist on essentially the opposite end of the political spectrum. Myrdal was reportedly furious about sharing the prize.
Which tells you something about Hayek's stature. You couldn't give the economics Nobel to someone at either pole without including him.
Now let's talk about the idea that is genuinely his most important contribution. The knowledge problem. 1945. Hayek publishes a paper called The Use of Knowledge in Society. 15 pages. In those 15 pages, he demolishes the theoretical case for central planning.
Here is the argument. The case for central planning assumes that the knowledge needed to run an economy can be collected, processed, and acted upon by a central authority. Give the planners enough data, enough computing power, enough smart people, and they can allocate resources better than a chaotic market.
Sounds plausible. It is essentially what tech companies pitch today when they talk about data-driven optimization. And Hayek says fundamentally wrong.
Why?
Because most of the knowledge that matters in an economy is not the kind that can be collected. It is local. It is tacit. It is specific to a time and a place in a way that cannot be transmitted to a distant authority.
Give me an example.
The example he uses, a farmer who knows his field. Not just the soil composition in a database somewhere. He knows the texture of this specific corner after last night's rain, and whether that means he should plant differently this week. That knowledge exists in his hands and his 40 years of experience. It does not go into a spreadsheet.
Or a shopkeeper who knows that demand in his neighborhood is running unusually high this afternoon. Or a trader who can see right now that an opportunity exists between two markets that will close in hours. Real-time, embodied, distributed across millions of minds, and perishable.
The central planner, no matter how brilliant, no matter how much data they have, cannot aggregate this. By the time information travels up the hierarchy, it is out of date. It gets distorted at every step. And the person at the bottom knows they cannot transmit their full knowledge upward, so they stop trying.
This is not just politically dangerous. Hayek's deeper point is that central planning is epistemically impossible. The central planner cannot have the information they would need to plan well. It is not a question of better computers or smarter algorithms. The knowledge problem is structural.
And this is where the price system becomes central. Hayek's insight about prices is one of the most elegant ideas in all of economics. Prices are not just numbers. They are compressed information packets.
Walk me through that.
If the price of copper suddenly rises, every user of copper everywhere in the world receives a signal simultaneously. Use less copper, find substitutes, innovate around it. Nobody needs to know why the price rose. Maybe a mine collapsed in Chile. Maybe there is a shortage in Asia. Doesn't matter.
The price encodes all of that information and broadcasts it to everyone who needs to act on it. No central authority could do this. No bureaucracy could coordinate the decisions of millions of copper users in response to an event in Chile as fast as a price movement.
And the miracle is not just that it works, it is that it works with no one in charge and no one understanding more than their tiny piece of it. The farmer does not need to know about the Chilean mine. He just sees copper pipe costs more and switches to something else.
Okay. So that is the knowledge problem and the price system. Now let's talk about spontaneous order, the broader philosophical framework Hayek built on top of these ideas.
Hayek had this concept he called catalaxy, the market order, which is one instance of a broader class he called spontaneous orders. A spontaneous order is a complex, functional structure that emerges from human action, but was never designed by any human mind.
Language is the classic example. Nobody designed English. No committee decided grammar rules, no founding document specified vocabulary. English emerged from millions of speakers over centuries, each making tiny local adjustments. And yet it works, it expresses nuance, poetry, technical precision, humor.
Common law is another example. The body of case law governing much of the English-speaking world, nobody planned it. It evolved through judges making incremental decisions, building on precedent. The system has a coherent logic no individual judge ever consciously designed.
And markets. No single planner decided Munich should have 20 bakeries, or what a coffee bean from Ethiopia should cost. Those outcomes emerged from billions of individual interactions under shared rules.
Hayek contrasts spontaneous orders with what he calls organizations, design structures with explicit goals. A firm, an army, a government ministry. These can be managed, but their complexity is bounded by what the designer can comprehend.
And the critical insight, when you try to make a spontaneous order behave like an organization, when you try to give a market a single goal, like equality or maximum growth or zero carbon, you destroy the very thing that made it work.
Because a market functions by serving millions of individual purposes simultaneously, the moment you subordinate it to one purpose, you have broken the feedback mechanism that allowed it to serve all those purposes.
The word Hayek uses for the market order, catalaxy, is actually derived from the Greek word for exchange. He chose it deliberately to distinguish the market from any designed order. It has no goal. It is a process, not an outcome.
And the beauty of that process, what Hayek called the discovery procedure, is that it continuously reveals information that nobody had before. The market discovers what things are worth. Before you put something in the market, you don't know. After millions of transactions, you do.
Which is why command economies kept getting prices wrong. They had to guess what things were worth because they had eliminated the discovery process that would have told them.
This leads us to The Road to Serfdom, published in 1944, probably Hayek's most famous and most misread book. The argument: central economic planning inevitably tends towards political tyranny. Not because planners are evil. Hayek explicitly says most are well-intentioned, but because of structural logic.
What's the structural argument?
Three steps. First, to plan effectively, you need power to enforce the plan. People don't naturally arrange their affairs to fit your plan. So coercion becomes necessary. You need to redirect resources, restrict choices, compel compliance.
Second, the planner has to make value choices that markets previously made implicitly. Who gets housing? Who gets healthcare? Who gets opportunity? The market allocated these through prices. Now you are allocating them through political decisions. Those decisions become contested.
Third, and most importantly, when the plan fails, and it will fail because of the knowledge problem, the planner faces a choice: accept that planning is impossible, or demand more power to make the plan work. Most planners choose the second option.
Each failure justifies more control, which creates new failures, which justifies even more control. A ratchet towards totalitarianism.
Now here is where the misreading happened. Many people took this as saying any government intervention leads to Nazism. That is not what Hayek said. He explicitly supported a minimum income floor. He supported public provision of infrastructure and health. He supported the rule of law.
What he opposed was using government to direct economic activity towards particular outcomes, to plan who produces what, who gets what, at what price. That is what leads to the ratchet.
The Road to Serfdom became a massive popular success, partly because Reader's Digest published a condensed version read by millions of Americans in the late 1940s. That condensed version lost the nuance. It shaped a generation of American conservatism that was more absolutist about markets than Hayek himself ever was.
He also had this important distinction between the rule of law and the rule of men. General rules applying equally to everyone, that is the rule of law, the foundation of a free society. Specific interventions directing particular individuals toward particular ends, that is the rule of men, and that is where freedom erodes.
And his critique of social justice, which still makes people uncomfortable. Hayek argued the concept of social justice as applied to markets is meaningless. The market is not an agent with intentions. It cannot be just or unjust. The outcomes are the result of millions of individual decisions, not of any plan or purpose.
That is a genuinely provocative position. And I think it contains an important insight even if you do not accept the conclusion. Okay, my turn. Let's talk about where Hayek was wrong or taken too far.
Please.
First, the taken too far problem. Hayek was appropriated by Thatcher and Reagan as intellectual cover for something much more radical than what he actually argued. He explicitly supported a minimum income floor. Thatcherism dismantled the safety net. Reagan slashed welfare. They used Hayek's rhetoric while ignoring his safety net.
That is fair. But the ideas he did argue for, deregulation, privatization, price liberalization, those were genuinely Hayekian. You cannot fully separate him from his political appropriators.
Second critique, market failures are real. Climate change is the clearest case. Carbon is a global externality. The people most affected, future generations, people in low-lying countries, are not party to any market transaction. The price system, left to itself, will not price carbon correctly.
And actually many Hayekians accept this. The Hayekian solution to climate change is a carbon tax. Use the price system to incorporate the externality. You are not replacing the market, you are correcting its information signal.
Except getting to a global carbon price requires international coordination on a scale the market won't produce spontaneously. You need political agreement from every major economy. That is not something that emerges from spontaneous order. It is a genuine tension in the framework.
I'll grant you that one.
Third, information asymmetry and market power. Big tech is the obvious case. Google, Meta, Amazon, market mechanisms have not corrected their scale and dominance. The market produced concentration that I think would genuinely horrify Hayek.
He was deeply worried about monopoly. He thought it was corrosive to the spontaneous order. The question is whether his framework gives us the tools to fight it.
Related, the surveillance capitalism problem. Hayek celebrated the market as a decentralized information processor. But surveillance capitalism is an asymmetric one. These companies know vastly more about their customers than customers know about them. The price signal is polluted. People make supposedly free choices in information environments engineered to manipulate them.
That is a genuinely new problem Hayek could not have anticipated.
But it follows logically from his own framework. If you believe markets work because they process dispersed information, and then you allow a handful of companies to monopolize that information processing while keeping the data asymmetric, you have broken the mechanism Hayek was celebrating.
In a sense, big tech is more compatible with Hayek's nightmare scenario than with his dream. A handful of private planners with access to more data than any government in history. That is not spontaneous order. That is something new and quite alarming.
Fourth critique, distributional blindness. Hayek's framework has almost nothing to say about the distribution of outcomes. He cares about the fairness of the process, not whether the outcomes are acceptable. A spontaneous order can function perfectly by his standards while producing grotesque inequality.
And his response would be that the market distributes according to how much people contribute to satisfying others' wants. That is not perfectly correlated with effort or virtue or need, but it is not random.
Fifth, and most uncomfortable, the Pinochet problem. Hayek visited Pinochet's Chile twice in the 1970s and early 1980s. the Pinochet government implemented radical economic liberalization. And Hayek was broadly positive about the economic direction, despite the torture, the disappearances, the systematic murder of political opponents.
That is a real and serious moral failing. He wrote a letter to Margaret Thatcher defending Chile as an example of economic freedom. I do not think you can defend that. It suggests that economic freedom was separable from, and could be prioritized over, basic human rights. For a thinker whose political philosophy is supposed to protect individuals from concentrated power, that is a deep problem.
His Road to Serfdom warned against left-wing authoritarianism with great energy. His critique of right-wing authoritarianism in the service of economic liberalization was much, much quieter. That asymmetry matters.
I think it is important to sit with that. You cannot say, I am for individual freedom against the state, and then shrug at the systematic murder of individuals by the state because you like what the state is doing to interest rates.
And I think it reveals something about the limits of economics as a moral framework. Hayek was a brilliant economist and social philosopher. But he sometimes treated economic freedom as if it were the only freedom. Political freedom, physical safety, the freedom not to be tortured, these got crowded out by the elegance of his economic model.
Okay, let us talk about Keynes. Because here we can look at how history actually tested these ideas in real time.
The setup, two brilliant men, same historical moment, opposite prescriptions. The Great Depression of the 1930s. Hayek at the London School of Economics. Keynes at Cambridge. Between them they define the debate that shapes economic policy for the rest of the century.
John Maynard Keynes, perhaps the most influential economist who ever lived. His argument: markets do not self-correct in the time frame that matters. When private investment collapses, as it did in 1929, you get a coordination failure. Everyone waits for someone else to start investing. Nobody does. The economy stays depressed.
The solution: government steps in. Fiscal stimulus. Spend money into the economy to restart demand. As Keynes famously said, in the long run we are all dead. Hayek's advice to let the market self-correct meant tolerating massive unemployment for years. Keynes said that was politically and morally unacceptable.
Hayek's response: government spending crowds out private investment. It distorts price signals. And most importantly, the recession is the correction. When malinvestment needs to be liquidated, artificially supporting demand just prolongs the agony. You need to let the reallocation happen.
They debated in person and in journal pages through the early 1930s. A genuine clash of intellectual titans. And then Hayek essentially stopped responding to Keynes after the general theory appeared in 1936.
He later admitted he never wrote the definitive rebuttal he had planned. He said by the time he could marshal the arguments, the world had moved on. Keynes had won the policy argument.
There is something almost poignant about that. Hayek was arguably the more rigorous theorist in the 1930s debate. He won the academic argument among many economists at the time. But Keynes won the policy argument because his prescription was actionable in a crisis. Governments could do something, and they needed to do something.
And Hayek's prescription, let the liquidation happen, was politically impossible when unemployment was 25% and people were starving. You can be theoretically correct and practically irrelevant.
Which is itself a Hayekian lesson. Theory divorced from the real world of human suffering and political possibility is not good economics.
Now, who won the debate? The honest answer changes depending on what year you ask. The 1940s through the 1970s, Keynes won. The post-war settlement, the welfare state, Bretton Woods managed capitalism, was built on Keynesian ideas. Governments actively managed demand. It worked. Western economies grew rapidly.
Then stagflation hit in the 1970s. The oil shocks combined with Keynesian demand management produced something the Keynesian model said was impossible: high inflation and high unemployment simultaneously. This was Hayek's moment.
Milton Friedman's monetarist ideas, compatible with Hayek's framework, displaced Keynesian demand management as the policy consensus.
The 1980s, Hayek's intellectual descendants reshaped the Western economies. Thatcher, Reagan, the Washington Consensus. Deregulation, privatization, tax cuts. there is no alternative to markets.
Then 2008 happened. The financial crisis. And every government in the world did exactly what Keynes prescribed. Massive fiscal stimulus, bank bailouts, quantitative easing. Nobody was worried about crowding out when the global banking system was collapsing.
Although a strict Hayekian would say the 2008 crisis was itself the predictable outcome of Greenspan's cheap money policy through the 2000s. The Keynesians saved us from a crisis that Hayekian analysis predicted.
Which is a bit like an arsonist being praised for his firefighting. The boom planted the seeds of the bust. But once the bust arrived, you couldn't lecture people about liquidation.
Then 2020, COVID. Government spent trillions without apology. The largest Keynesian experiment in history. And it stabilized the economies remarkably quickly.
And then 2022, inflation arrived, which you could argue was partly the result of printing too much money too fast, precisely what Hayek and the Austrians had always warned about. Excessive money creation plus supply chain disruptions equals exactly what Austrian business cycle theory predicted.
So what is the honest answer? Neither one. Both models capture something real about how economies behave in different circumstances. The ideological war continues because each side can point to historical moments where their framework gave better predictions.
I should mention, there were these brilliant YouTube videos in 2010 and 2011. Russ Roberts, an economist at George Mason, made rap battles between Hayek and Keynes. Fear the boom and bust and fight of the century. They got millions of views. They did more to educate the public about this debate than most academic papers.
A rap battle between two economists who had been dead for decades. What a time.
Economics education, completely unironically. If you haven't seen them, go watch them after this episode.
Okay. Let us bring this forward to 2026. I want to look at where Hayek's ideas are most alive and most contested right now.
Start with Bitcoin. In 1976, Hayek wrote a book called The Denationalization of Money. The argument, governments should not have a monopoly on currency. Competing private currencies would be more stable than state monopolies because they would compete for users.
A currency that inflated would lose users to one that didn't. He never got to see it happen. But Bitcoin is essentially this idea implemented in cryptographic code. No central issuer. Fixed supply. Decentralized.
Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever they are, almost certainly read Hayek. The parallels are too precise to be accidental.
Though I will note, the crypto experiment has not perfectly validated Hayek's vision either. Bitcoin is not used as a medium of exchange by most people. It has become a speculative asset. And stablecoins are pegged to the dollar, the very fiat currency Hayek wanted to compete away.
True. The technology is Hayekian. Whether the actual outcomes match his predictions is more complicated. Currency competition is happening, but it is messier and more speculative than he imagined.
And blockchain technology more broadly is spontaneous order as an engineering principle. Ethereum, decentralized autonomous organizations, peer-to-peer networks, all embody the idea that complex coordination can emerge from simple rules applied consistently without a central coordinator.
Open source software is another example. Linux, nobody designed it as a whole. It grew through millions of individual contributions, each person scratching their own itch, the whole thing evolving into software that now runs most of the world's servers. Emergent complexity. No designer.
Now, artificial intelligence. Does AI finally solve the knowledge problem that Hayek identified?
The optimistic case. Large language models can process more information than any central planner ever could. Maybe the Soviet Union just needed GPT-6.
And I think this completely misunderstands the knowledge problem. Hayek's point was not that central planners lacked computing power. It was that the relevant knowledge is not in any database. It is tacit. It is what a farmer knows about his field tomorrow morning, knowledge that exists only in the lived experience of being that farmer in that place at that time.
The knowledge problem is about real-time local specificity, not searchable archives. An LLM trained on the internet does not know what the baker in Schwabing knows about his customers at 7 a.m. today. That knowledge does not make it into training data. Never will.
There is also a deeper point. AI systems trained on historical data will reproduce historical patterns. They are fundamentally backward-looking. Markets are forward-looking, they aggregate expectations about the future, they discover prices that have never existed before. Those are different things.
Though I will note, some Hayekians use the knowledge problem as a magical shield against any challenge. The coordination problems that seemed intractable in 1945 do look somewhat different with 2026-level technology. We should be honest about that uncertainty.
Fair criticism.
Now climate change. The hardest case for Hayekians.
The purest Hayekian solution is a carbon price. You do not tell people what to produce or consume. You correct the price signal, make carbon-intensive activities bear their true social cost. Then let the market figure out how to respond. Genuinely elegant Hayekian economics.
Most mainstream economists agree that a carbon price is the most efficient mechanism. It uses the price system rather than replacing it.
But getting to a global carbon price requires international coordination, every country agreeing to impose a cost on their own industries while competitors might not. That is a collective action problem the market cannot solve spontaneously. You need a Leviathan.
And Hayek spent his career arguing against concentrations of global authority. So the most Hayekian solution to the most important collective problem of our time requires precisely the kind of global coordination his framework is designed to avoid.
Some Hayekians resolve this by denying the market failure exists, which is intellectually dishonest.
And some resolve it by accepting carbon pricing as consistent with Hayek. You are correcting the price signal, not replacing the market, which is actually defensible. But it requires acknowledging the market needs correction, which some Hayekians resist.
The climate question is, I think, the best stress test for any economic framework right now. A framework that cannot generate a coherent response to the largest collective action problem of our time has a problem.
Agreed. And I think the Hayekian contribution to that discussion is real but incomplete. Carbon pricing is the right tool. But getting there requires political will and international coordination that the spontaneous order will not deliver on its own.
Okay. We are coming towards the end. What do we actually take from Hayek? What survives the critiques?
I will start. The knowledge problem is genuinely important and I think it is underappreciated. Anytime someone proposes to replace market mechanisms with top-down direction, whether it is a government, a tech company, or a well-meaning NGO, you should ask, where is the knowledge going to come from? Who has it, how will it be aggregated, and what is lost in the aggregation?
That is a genuinely useful heuristic. And the price system insight, prices as information, is one of the most elegant ideas in social science. The fact that a billion people can coordinate their copper usage in response to an event none of them witnessed, just by responding to a number that changes, that is extraordinary. We take it completely for granted.
The spontaneous order framework also gives us a way to think about why top-down redesigns of complex systems fail in predictable ways. Healthcare reform, urban planning, financial regulation. When you try to reshape a complex evolved system according to a simple theory, you break things you didn't know were there.
What I do not take is the inference that because markets are generally better than central planning, all market outcomes are acceptable and all government intervention is suspect. Market failures are real. Distributional outcomes matter. The captured spontaneous order, where concentrated interests hijack the evolved institutions Hayek celebrated, is a genuine phenomenon.
I take the epistemological humility above everything else. Hayek's deepest point is not about markets versus government. It is about the limits of what any mind or institution can know and plan. That applies to corporations as much as governments. It applies to AI developers who think they have solved coordination.
In a world where centralization of power keeps accelerating, where tech platforms are becoming the new planners, where AI threatens to make top-down coordination seem more feasible than ever, Hayek's warning about the hubris of central design seems more urgent than ever.
And yet, his framework does not answer what to do about people failed by the spontaneous order. It does not answer what to do about inequality, the market generates but doesn't correct. It does not answer what to do about collective action problems markets genuinely cannot solve.
He gave us an extraordinarily powerful tool for understanding why some interventions fail and why market coordination has strengths that planned systems lack. He did not give us a complete answer to what a just and functional society looks like.
Which means the debate continues.
It strikes me that part of what makes Hayek endure is that his question, how do complex social orders coordinate themselves without central direction, is increasingly urgent. The internet, decentralized finance, AI governance, global supply chains, these are all coordination problems at a scale Hayek could not have imagined.
And every time someone proposes a top-down solution, whether it is a government regulating AI, or a central bank managing a digital currency, or a global body setting carbon prices, you hear Hayek's ghost asking, who has the knowledge? Who has the right incentives? What is the feedback mechanism?
Those are the right questions. Even if you disagree with his answers.
And I think the most honest position is, he was right about the things he was right about, which are enormously important, and wrong about some things that were also important, which is what you would expect from a thinker who spent 7 decades grappling with some of the hardest problems in social science.
The history of economic thought is full of people who had one big idea and either oversold it or watched it get hijacked. Hayek had several big ideas, and he lived long enough to see all of them oversold and hijacked.
Which is perhaps the ultimate vindication and the ultimate indignity at the same time.
As it should be. The honest engagement with hard ideas, the willingness to say this critique is right, while also saying this insight is correct, that is where the actual thinking happens.
One last thought. Hayek's liberalism was not complacency. He was not saying the world is fine as it is. He was saying, be humble about what you can fix by design, and be alert to the ways that well-intentioned interventions generate new problems. That is not conservatism. That is epistemic caution.
And in 2026, in an era of techno-optimism, of AI systems that claim to know what you want before you do, of platforms that promise to solve coordination through surveillance, that caution feels more necessary than ever.
Friedrich Hayek, the man who explained why the economy works and why attempts to improve it so often make it worse. One of the great minds of the 20th century, with all the brilliance and all the blind spots that description implies.
That is it for Claude Talks today. If this sparked something, read the 1945 paper, The Use of Knowledge in Society. 15 pages. One of the most consequential things written in the entire 20th century.
The Road to Serfdom is worth reading too. The actual book, not the Reader's Digest condensation. It is more nuanced than its reputation.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Share this if you think someone would find it useful. We will see you next time.
Thanks for listening.